Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus.
Makalua.
The main team.
Mega Bears fan.
With guest co-hosts.
Christy.
And obligatory background noise.
Obligatory background noise.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Polycast, episode 332. I am your guest for today, the Christie, and I'm joined by the usual gang of cohorts, Canis Albinus.
So, nuclear plants, not so good.
Makalua.
We've seen a lot of boom going on, apparently.
Mega Bears fan.
I have functioning internet today. Hooray!
Hooray!
And everyone's favorite, the Mian team.
I'm bringing you some special tactics. Also, nuclear reactors are good.
Yes, they are.
Maybe.
We just need to, not have any context, and then that can be true.
Yeah, there was a theme there. I feel like I was missing something.
I'm sure we'll figure it out.
All right, so as everybody knows, we now have a brand new expansion pack that has been out since a week before this show was recorded, because scheduling is fun. So what we're gonna start with, those of us who have played the new expansion will tell us some of their interesting stories that have happened with some various hijinks that have been played.
Well, I don't know if I really have any hijinks. I've just kind of played and it's been interesting.
Thoughts and opinions then?
I may be a little bit too in love with the way the Maori start.
No.
I really like that. I don't know why, but I just I can't not play them because I like starting the ocean. I like invading somebody's continent, and then what happened, because I was playing last night with Josh and Dino, and I was I ended up landing right next to France, who tried to expand in my face, and then I ended up punching her in the face. The Toa are a little powerful and available pretty quick.
Aren't they just a warrior replacement?
No, sword.
Oh, yeah.
But you don't
you
have
said,
to.
You say available quick, but it actually takes double the amount of science to get them compared to sword rushing.
What do they come out again? I have not.
They come with construction. Oh, yeah. So you need to get 7 techs to unlock them versus, I think, it's 3 or 4 for swords.
Do they have a resource requirement? That's
no.
That's the thing. There's no resource
requirement. No, there's no resource. I think you can just go straight in and you can, but their strength, and at least in the games I've played, I've been able to get them early enough and quick enough, and then I can just go right in and start punching somebody in the face. I was even playing a single player game earlier before that, and I had the same thing where I ended up with India right next door to me, and in both games I got attacked first, but in both games I turned around and your empire's mine now, thanks.
Maori also, I think, get a pretty decent production bonus because they get I think one free extra production on unimproved forest and woods tiles, so you get them out pretty quick as well.
Yeah, but you still need to get a decent amount of science in order to get them out. I had this argument on Reddit with someone lately. They were saying the Toa are way overpowered and need to be nerfed, and I was basically saying they take a lot longer to get out. Once they do get out, yes, they're more powerful, but they take a lot longer. You're a lot weaker in theory until then. Besides, I also had the argument of, if you're going to nerf the Toas, you need to nerf the Varus. They're basically exactly the same.
Oh, yeah.
I think the big thing, I guess, is it's really going to come down to what Eurekas you're getting. Because just with so many things in the early parts of the game, if you're getting the Eurekas to get to that tech, it goes real quick. If you're not getting those Eurekas, it feels like it takes forever.
I did look it up, and when it comes to getting towards construction, I think the only thing you can really Eureka is, well, you can't Eureka construction itself because you're not getting water mills because you're not going down there. I think you can Eureka horseback riding because you'll have pastures, but I think that's it.
Yeah, but there's also the potential of getting those Eureka
from
villages.
From
so yeah, you can get it from there too.
Which, if you're like me and you have a heavily modded game that has 3 times the amount of goody huts, you can pretty Eureka the entire bottom half of the tech tree within the first era.
No lucky huts, no.
Bill's favorites. It just feels like it's really quick comparatively to when if I tried to plant a swordsman rush, it would take forever and I wouldn't have iron. But because I don't have to worry about having iron, and I don't even necessarily have to beeline construction to get them at a decent, because usually I play it either quick or online. So it doesn't feel like it takes a long amount of time for me to get there. And in a lot of these cases, I'm already having an AI come up and try to attack me, and then But then, boom, here's a Toa, and I'm just going to curb stomp the rest of your ship because of it.
I guess it's also very reliant on actually getting the start that you need as well.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you don't find, or well, I say start, but obviously, if you don't find the good landing spot that has all that basically has all the growth, you're not going to get the production bonus to get them out as quick, I suppose.
I can't imagine them outperforming things like Nubian archers or similar. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I think it's hard to find anything that outperforms the Nubian archers. Those things are pretty boss.
Yeah.
They come out pretty quickly as well.
And plus, like, you can still archer and sword rush on deity, so it's I don't know. We'll see how they do in MP, but I think they're probably okay.
They perform better also in the middle phase as well. They have that bit more of a bridge.
Yeah, they're like something between swords and knights in that regard, probably, but we'll see how they do overall.
And maybe I just don't try to sword rush often enough, and this is more typical than I think, but it feels almost cheaty sometimes, because sometimes I start with just archers and spearmen when they attack me, but then the Toa comes in like maybe like 10 turns into it, and then I can, because you've got that extra bonus to forest and rainforests, so I'm getting some production I might not normally, so it doesn't take long to build them, especially if I take that one policy card that has the 50% off, and then I'm just churning it out and just like wipe you off.
Has anyone played anyone that isn't the Maori?
I have played many people. I played the Inca and got a grand total of 6 mountains in my start. That was nice. I played Eleanor as both, and I only won as France because stupid Inca won a science victory on me. Sweden, I did a Sweden game where, what's his name? The guy with the feather headdress.
Monty?
Shaka, not Monty, Shaka.
Ah.
He was my best friend, and we were right next to each other, and I discovered just how much culture you can get from those outdoor museums, because I had like 10 cities and I had one in each type, so I put one down in every city and suddenly that's 100 culture just right within 2 turns. After that, there was no more trouble with culture. Who else did I play? I didn't play Coupe. I didn't play Phoenicia. I didn't play Canada. I tried to, but then I got one Tundra tile and said, nope, this is dumb. Mansa Musa,
only one.
I got one Tundra tile. It was terrible.
I hear that happens with Mansa as
Mansa
well.
Mansa Musa got one tile of desert, so I guess I'm just the crappy start guru, but...
That probably also depends on your map size and stuff like that. You play on smaller maps, you're more likely to see those tiny bits of terrain like that.
My Mansa game didn't have much desert near the start either, but it worked out all right. I mean, when I say much, there was some desert around the size, but I didn't start in the desert as much. It worked out. I was still rolling in so much money.
I have noticed that in the MP games that whenever somebody's got Mansa, it's like, so hit me up with a loan for, you know, so I can do this war. And they're like, sure.
It takes a little while to get started up, though. It was only after I finally got to something that was going, I was like, oh, right, this is a guy who has money. And then later on in the game, when I had an as of whatchamacallit city-state that used to be Carthage, plus democracy, plus Suguba, I was buying units for free.
Wow.
Addis of reduction.
Yeah, there's a couple balance issues in the game. I haven't even played it much, but I've been following in the screenshots and such while I've been away from my computer, like on my phone and such, so, you know.
Indie rock band flipping an entire sieve. Yeah, that's perfectly balanced.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you showed me that, too. That's pretty ridiculous. So I have yet to play the game because I'm playing in a Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup tournament, and that's ending soon. So I'll be taking a look at Civ 6 in the near future.
We'll experience all of this in person.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Dennis, it's funny you were giving out about your Canada game not having much Tundra, whereas the Canada game I played was pretty much all Tundra. God, growing in that is a nightmare.
All you need is a volcano.
But even with that, the one that erupted, like, it maybe erupted a few times, and didn't give me all that much food.
Telling me you don't play on 4 Disaster all the time?
That one, I think, I don't think I did on that one. I think it was only 2 or 3.
Although I've been on 3 for most of my games.
Although, was that the annoying thing in my Canada one was one time I got a crippling blizzard in the middle of my empire, and I suddenly had about 40 tiles pillaged and lost about 15 population as that went through. Ooh. And I was like, what the hell? And
then, I've never seen a disaster affect more than like 4 or 5 tiles.
Oh, no, I had a crippling blizzard spawn basically in the middle of my empire and then just track right through my empire.
Oh, right, because it moves.
It moves, yeah. And it practically almost killed 3 cities and the capital down to almost nothing. And I had to redo it.
Because, as we all know, Canada doesn't know how to deal with blizzards.
What setting was that on, that you got that happening?
I can't remember if it was 3 or 4. I don't know. I'd have to check, obviously, the save game at some point. I've been messing around with them. I haven't gone think one game I went down to one, but that was just for a hang around game, really.
I don't think stuff like that should happen on default or like low settings, but I could, it's, you know, if you're going to turn up the disasters because you want the disasters, I guess it's fine. Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. The very first game I turned, I like cranked it way up, and I was like, "Ooh, hey, these volcanoes swim, are right? Suddenly, yeah." But that game was Pachacuti, and obviously all the volcanoes and mountains around, and suddenly it was like, "Oh, hey, my super yield terrace farms are even more yieldy now." Assuming, well, of course, you have to rebuild them every 10 turns when the volcano goes off, but price to pay.
I did like with Canada that I did not have to worry about generating faith at all, because the only thing that Canada actually needs to spend faith on is the rock bands, because your unique unit can build national parks, so you don't need to save up faith for naturalists. So I just went like totally atheist, like nope, no faith for us, and that was nice, not having to even think about that.
I was more happy about that for with the Mounties, because with Terra Mirabilis it changes the naturalist to come with gold, so it's like, oh, I don't have to waste my money on these guys now. Buy a Mountie costs so much less than a naturalist.
Wait, you have a mod that lets you buy naturalists with gold? Or is there some way to do that in the base game? Because I don't remember.
No, it's a mod. It's Terra Mirabilis does it.
Okay. I don't remember there being any way to buy naturalists with gold.
Yeah, no, it's I play heavily. I got like 80 mods on my game.
You're right.
My Civ is nothing like vanilla Civ anymore.
I recently discovered the joy of modding. I just doubled the number of natural wonders, and that was all I needed to do.
Yeah, I used to use that until Terra Mirabilis came out. It was pretty fun having them all around. Then Terra's like suddenly, okay, here, like 3 times the natural wonders, and we're going to double the size of the natural wonder pool as well.
I kept running into natural wonders that I didn't even realize were in the game, and I can't remember if they're in Rise and Fall or Gathering Storm. I remember I was playing this game, and there were like 7 natural wonders I didn't recognize.
Gathering Storm, I think, added quite a few.
It added, I think, another 7 or 8. But yeah. there's a few I rarely ever see. I rarely ever see Shang-Chi Danya, the Rainbow Mountain thing.
I've never seen that one.
I've yet to see that.
Matterhorn, I don't find all that often.
I find that one every time.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, see, that's another one.
I was playing a multiplayer game, and the person I was playing with had chocolate hills, and I thought, oh, you just win because you have hills made out of chocolate. So, yeah. and then while my scout was standing right next to it, he had a tornado go through the chocolate hills, and I'm like, oh my goodness, chocolate tornadoes. I don't know whether to be terrified or the happiest person alive.
Well, you know. Yes.
Just stand there, wait for it to blast, to go right through you, and just stand there as you're like bathed in chocolate.
Yeah. And then the next day I bummed myself out by looking up what the chocolate hills actually are, and I am sad to report that the chocolate hills in real life are not actually made out of chocolate.
Aww.
I know.
Heartbroken. Like the moon isn't made out of cheese.
Yeah, apparently the moon is also not made out of cheese, and I'm sorry, we had to break some hearts today.
I reject the evidence of this.
They've been lying to us all along.
You mean the moon dust they brought back wasn't cheese powder?
I don't think you'd want to eat that.
They tried to make it into cheese, but it didn't really work.
And with this revelation, I can only assume that the Rainbow Mountain is not actually made out of rainbows.
Well, if it was, there'd have to be lots of gold sitting there.
Doesn't it look rainbowish, though, because it's the kind where it's got the layers kind of like the Grand Canyon does, except it's a mountain?
I don't know. I've never seen it.
I'm thinking I've seen it at some point in the thing, and that's what it looks like, but I could be totally wrong.
Well,
excuse me,
of
thinking
souls.
Of something else.
Sounds pretty.
So I was originally playing the game, and I complained to somebody in our chat group that there were a lot of barbarians everywhere, because I kept running into like 4 or 5 barb scouts on the same screen at one time. And apparently the game decided to take pity on me, because since that game, I have not seen a single barbarian on any continent I start on. And I don't
From what I understand, it's actually bugs. People are talking about it on the forum. So like the barbs actually do have a tendency to congregate on one continent specifically.
Yes.
Or in one area like that. And that's a consistent problem across games.
Apparently so do the city-states. That game that I was playing as the Maori, where my friend that I was playing with had the Chocolate Hills, he kept complaining to me that there were no barbarians on his continent at all. And I was the Maori, and I actually started out next to an island. So I was on this island that was in between 2 continents. So I was sending explorers both ways, and I went the opposite direction from him, and I found a continent that had, I think, 7 city-states, and I came across probably, like, 6 barbarian encampments in, like, within the first 100 turns. It was ridiculous. Jeez. And then he's over there, like, where are all the barbarians? And I'm like, well, apparently they're all over here.
I can definitely say I have experienced this, especially in a couple of games, like, I was on the bad continent, if you will, and I'd clear a barb camp, and then suddenly it would practically respawn in one tile off in the Fog of War on the other side of my
yes.
Yes. Empire, and I'd be going back and forth ping-ponging them constantly.
That same game, I saw at least twice, I would kill an encampment, and then I would move my units away, and I would look over there a couple turns later, and that same encampment would be right back there at the exact same place.
Yeah.
I've had it even worse. I've killed an encampment, then as the turn rolls over, it respawns in the fog of war two tiles away from the unit that just killed the previous camp.
They fled the one and founded the other.
And I have seen the same at the city-states, although I always play on like a huge map, so there is always kind of a semi-half small continent that has five or six city-states there. Although I think that's handy because it means they don't get killed by the AI.
Okay, yeah, so we kind of gum up the AI's approach to them.
Yeah, they've turned up the AI aggression on city-states again.
Well, if you want the AIs to not kill all the city-states, you could always just make all the AIs Canada.
Please, you know, just bully them instead?
Please,
when
I'm playing normal games as it is, it's bad enough that old Canada keeps playing just because Canada's in the game. I don't need every AI being Canada.
I have had old Canada stuck in my head for, 2 weeks now? And I only know, the first line. After Home and Native Land, I don't know any more of the song.
I don't even know that. I just know old Canada.
So, we got the Hall of Fame, which made me very sad because all of my previous victories don't count toward the Hall of Fame.
Well, what you need to do is you need to just save every game the turn before you win, so that when the Hall of Fame does get patched in, you just reload them all, play one turn, get your Hall of Fame credit, and then, you know, be good with it. So you just have to start doing that on every new Civ release ever.
Yeah, I'm just not going to just let it do retroactive. Besides, when I'm finally done with all the new Civs, I'm sure I'm going to be playing through every old Civ anyway, especially with the new ones that got changed.
There's also, when you change the game rules, it resets everything to, oh, well, these are the victories you had in the base game.
And it remembers that too?
No, it doesn't remember them. It has a list for them, but it doesn't remember the games you played before the expansion came out, because functionality wasn't there.
But it will remember them moving forward now. So if you are changing the rules, you'll fill out the Hall of Fame on all three rule sets?
Yes. The ones with scenarios and that stuff.
Huh, okay, that's interesting. I didn't recognize that.
In order to fully super clear Civ 6, you basically have to win with every single Civ in all three rule sets and then beat every scenario with every side that you can play as.
And every victory type.
Every victory type. You only have to do it once per game rule, though.
That is a very high
replay value.
Replay value.
Or tedium value.
It's only tedious if you don't like a particular version of the game, which some of the scenarios are pretty tedious, but the Alexander scenario is just a pain in the backside.
I don't think I've played a scenario yet in Civ 6. I only ever played one or two of them in Civ 5, and one was the, I think, Mongolian or Hun one, and I got my butt kicked, so I was like, I think I'll stop playing scenarios for a while.
The Alexander one is basically the Mongolian one from Civ 5, except you don't tech in it like you did in the Civ 5 version. Basically, you start out as Macedon, and you have to take every city on the map within a certain number of turns.
Mm. I always meant to play the Civil War one in Civ 5, but I never got around to it.
That one was fun, but hard, if you did it on Deity. I think the way that I won that one on Deity was I just suicide rushed Richmond, and I got it on the last unit, Pickett's Recharge.
So a bit of a smoky segue. How have people thought about climate change aspects of the game?
It's weird.
I want to play it for myself before commenting, but if what people are typing on the forums is accurate, then it's messed up in some cases.
Oh, I would agree with that, yeah.
I've only played one game where it was relevant, and I found it pretty trivial to deal with as long as you're not a coastal Civ and have all of your cities on the coast, because as far as I can tell so far, the only permanent effect of the climate change is the flooding of coastal tiles. All the other things are just more disasters, which just pillage tiles, which you can trivially fix by just having some builders hanging around. Yeah. So I'm kind of that doesn't seem fair. And another thing that I noticed is that I haven't actually tried this out, but in the future era, there is a tech called global warming mitigation, which allows you to, I guess, scrub CO2 from the atmosphere in exchange for diplomatic favor. And from what I understand, you can only use this to scrub the CO2 that you have produced.
Yeah.
So you can't clean other people's messes. You can only clean yours. So I'm imagining this diplomatic victory strategy now where you pollute as much as you possibly can and then beeline to flood barriers so you can build the flood barrier in all your coastal cities and then watch all the other civs flood while you scrub all the CO2 that you produced and then use it to win the diplomatic victory. like effectively effectively diplomatically winning the game by destroying the world. And I'm like, that sounds like a little bit of a perverse incentive.
We will be talking about diplomatic victory a little bit later, but yeah, that kind of does work.
It's not the only way of making a lot of diplo favor, but yes, it is one of the ways.
Also, beeline computers, because that's where you build flood barriers. Yeah. You have to beeline that tech, otherwise they get very expensive very fast.
I'm still trying to work out what the actual build cost is. I think it's like base 100 times the number of tiles you have to protect, and I guess that multiplies by climate change phase number.
Well, you can see where flooding will happen, right?
Yeah.
So you can also just avoid things you care about getting flooded.
I see it when I have the settler selected. Is there an overlay that shows it as well? Because I haven't seen that yet.
There should be.
It's only in the settler lens, and it only really shows it for the tiles that aren't already settled. There's no current lens that shows flooding-capable tiles.
Because I'm pretty sure you can.
They're settled or not.
I'm pretty sure you can highlight over a tile with the mouse.
Oh, yeah,
the tooltip will tell you. I've yet to find a lens that is like, oh, here are all the tiles that are about to flood.
Yeah, it's not as at a glance. I'd also, speaking of this, I also wouldn't mind if there was a lens that shows what tiles have been made more fertile over the course of the game.
Yeah, you'd think that stuff would have been in the game.
Yeah, because I go around and I'm like, oh, hey, this stuff for, you know, a flood happens. Okay, it made 6 tiles more fertile, grand. But if I'm not specifically hovering over the area of the map where the flood happens, I don't see what gets made more fertile, and I have to go peering in to look at it.
Well, usually
there is a distinct graphic, so you can't see it. It's just if there's an improvement over it and the improvement's not pillaged, it is really hard to see flooding in particular.
They have a little pop-up thing that shows up whenever a yield changes, but if you've got any kind of window open, like a tech, you can't see it because it just goes underneath it.
Or your camber control gets sent to a unit on the other side of the map, and you don't see it either.
Yeah, there's also the little notification thing that you can click on, but I think that goes away after you hit end turn. So it doesn't stick around until it would be nice if at the very least, if that notification just stayed there until the event was over and the fertilized tiles stopped being fertilized. So you could always just click on it to go back to where it happened.
Problem with that is we have seen how well they are able to control exactly what stays where on the screen when it comes to notifications like that. So even though your certain things will stay there for the rest of the game, like you missed a wonder type things, things you want disappear instantly. Just like, ah. But with regard to global warming, I'm also very amused by just how you basically go from, oh, look, there's a little bit of potential for coastal flooding. 10 turns later, 3 meters of ocean rise have completed, and now all those tiles are gone.
Yeah, it cranks up way too quickly in my eyes. Especially if you have more than one save that actually gets to, like, start industrializing. If you have, if more than one AI industrializes at the same time, like, pretty much the ice caps just melt almost instantaneously.
Yeah, that's the other reason why you have to be able to get to flood barriers early, because if you start trying to build them when coastal flooding starts, you're never going to get them done, because before you get done with them, they're going to like double in cost because they're covering a bigger area now, and then before even that gets done, they're going to be covering an even bigger area, and at that point there's no point in even building them because everything's already gone.
Yeah, I think I remember a point where I was like a couple turns away from building a flood barrier, and then like I checked on the city and all of a sudden it was like, oh, 15 turns to complete. So like the cost seemed to go up while I was in the middle of building it.
Yeah.
One thing that did bother me about this is that someone was posting how they had built no factories, or like one factory. I think it was literally no factories though. And they only had 5 military units or 6 military units. They technically led the world in CO2 emissions, and that was causing global warming. That shouldn't happen. I think even on the higher settings, if there's no industrialization at all in the world, then they should probably be a little more lax on this.
Basically every, now I don't know the exact raw numbers, but I think that every unit of coal spent, whether that's to fuel a unit, to build a railroad, or to fuel to make power, is 3 CO2.
Does that include the coal that's spent per turn on the maintenance for certain units? Because I think an ironclad is 1 per turn, right?
Yes, ironclad is 1 per turn, and it'll basically make 3 CO2 per turn as it's burning the coal.
And that's whether you're using the ironclad for anything or not.
Yep, it's just by existing.
And I just think it's got to scale.
It gets a little worse later. But like, and then obviously, once you get into the modern atomic and everything starts to use oil, then you're burning oil into the atmosphere.
It's got to scale.
Like, it has to matter whether like you're building like 50 units and 10 factories versus 10 units and no factories. There should be a huge difference between those.
It almost makes me think that maybe they need something where you decommission units for like a temporary period of time so that they're not consuming the resources or producing CO2. So like you just say, oh, this ironclad is decommissioned and it's just parked in a harbor or something like that. So it's not burning coal. It's not emitting fossil greenhouse gases, just because if you have it and you're not using it, like that just sucks.
Problem yeah. is modern ships burn oil even when they're not commissioned. Like in the U.S. Navy, at least they have to fight rust by running electricity across the hulls of the ship to keep it from oxidizing, and that requires fuel.
But does it require as much fuel as if the ship were like out on active duty?
Probably not. I don't know.
I would imagine
sure.
it would be comparatively negligible between those two.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. I mean, maybe some trace amounts of energy are required to maintain the ship, but like not enough on the scale of Civ to warrant costing a whole resource and producing all the CO2.
I would argue that three guys with guns shouldn't cost oil. But, you know,
well,
the abstraction of the game is a little bit strange sometimes.
I could maybe understand a small upfront cost because, like, maybe you're making a bunch of plastic or something like that, you know, which maybe in the abstract way that Civ works requires oil.
I don't want to go into battle with a plastic gun.
Well, but there's well, plastics and rubbers. And...
Think of it as an abstraction of the gear it takes to equip those guys and the production cost of that.
And the logistics.
Yeah, I'm just being flippant.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not maintenance. Five oil up front. And that's another thing that about the game, too, is I don't like that every unit costs the same amount of resources. Like, for instance, I really wish that the knight had been, like, split. I think the default is 20 iron. I wish that the knight, for example, was split 10 horses, 10 iron.
Yeah, I hope they do change that at some point to make stuff take up multiple things, because then you can have your tanks. Right now, they changed tanks and modern armor to only require oil, whereas modern armor used to require aluminium.
Right, so. And I would like for modern units to also require iron, because, you know, iron goes into steel. So I could see, like, a tank being, like, 12 oil and 4 iron and 4 coal or something like that, you know, because you're using the iron and coal to make the steel.
That gets a little complicated, though.
A little bit.
Yeah, but, I mean, when you think about how the resources are used over the course of the game, obviously you start with iron and horses to kind of kit out your units, then nitre comes into the play. But then when you get coal, iron at least has a bit of a secondary use with iron and coal to make railroads. Horses kind of just stop being useful later on.
Yeah,
even nicer somewhat.
Right. It would be nice if all of the resources are useful for all of the game after you reveal them. Like, even if they're not going towards the military, if you're using them domestically. Maybe, for example, the entertainment complexes could have, like, a horse track thing that uses horses and provides amenity.
Where do the... It would be like the Kentucky Derby wonder.
Something like that.
Or something like that. But I would just really like to see the older resources continue to be useful later in the game, at least in trace amounts. You know, again, I'm not expecting a tank to need 20 iron. You know, a tank should not require a horse.
The horses are running on the treadmill inside the tank.
Yes.
Armored horses. Way to go.
At least they're not armored bears.
It's true.
Yes, the new Russian unique unit.
It's the Empire and Golden Compass or whatever that movie was.
Yeah. Like I understood in Civ 5 where every unit cost one copy of a resource that you didn't want to split the resources now. But now that a single unit costs 20 resources, I figured, you could probably split it up amongst different resources where it makes sense. And that would also kind of be beneficial, because if you don't have a lot of all the resources, you can still just spend a little bit of each one. I mean, maybe they could have even had different variants of some of the resource using units that, like, maybe have slightly different combat strengths but use slightly more or less of a specific resource. I mean, now that is getting really complicated, but it would be kind of nice to have different options for what's available to you and what you want to spend those resources on than just, all right, 20 iron to build a knight, even though he's on horseback.
Well, I think they would argue that's kind of why they brought in stuff like the Corsair and the Cuirassier, so that you actually had light and heavy cav that had a different resource at the same time, because Corsairs only require horses, whereas the knights require iron.
To have some units you can upgrade to between early and modern era. Yeah.
Yeah, it's also the same. Cavalry are horses, whereas Cuirassiers are nitre.
Right, but you also have the swordsman that uses the iron, so like I could see there being a split. So you've got the light cav that requires 20 horses, you've got the melee that requires 20 iron, and you've got the knight in between that requires 10 of each.
Requires 10 of each, and then if all else fails, you have the anti-cav, which doesn't require require anything. It's just weak.
I was also surprised to see that catapults did not require a resource.
But their upgrades do, and catapults suck. So
catapults do suck.
Contentious even in Civ 5 when they originally made catapults require iron. And it was like, really?
But again, in Civ 5, every unit required the same one copy of a resource. Like, they could have made it so that a catapult is like 5 iron or something like that.
It was still a strange choice, though. Cost anything in Civ 5.
I mean, technically, when you think about it, it's just a wood construction.
Yeah, they were usually built like on site. Well, the ones actually used in Siege anyway.
Yeah, I've actually.
It wasn't something you were building elsewhere and hauling across the field. I mean, when you get to later stuff like the trebuchets, that kind of had to be constructed elsewhere. But the catapult was just whatever wood we could get on. Here's some rope to bind it. Go. Where does iron come
from? Trebuchets
were
usually built on site too.
Trebuchets
were like packed up and moved on and then set up there, but they'd already like pre-prepared us in a city.
Depends on the size of it too. Because like the massive, I was thinking more of the massive ones, but yeah, I guess the smaller ones you could move around. But
well, what they would usually do, I think, is they would like get all the fittings and put them into the wood on site. The wood would usually be sourced on site, and then they'd build it from that with parts they already had.
Okay, fair enough.
I've actually advocated in the past that maybe military engineers should be available early, and the military engineer should spend a charge to build the catapult on site rather than it being a regular unit.
That would be interesting. Certainly give them some use, which they don't see a lot of right now.
They see a little bit more now that you need them to build railroads, but...
Yeah, that's pretty late in the game, but
I think they also build tunnels, right?
Yeah, they build them in tunnels.
Can the regular builder build tunnels?
Only if you're the Inca.
And technically, the Chapak Nan and tunnels are actually separate improvements.
By the way, you can sail boats through those.
that was a great screenshot. I love it.
That is pretty amazing.
I'm a battleship. I'm going to sail under the mountain range.
I also saw a screenshot of somebody who had used the Panama Canal and two cities to build something like it was a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, a 7-tile long canal.
Yeah.
It's an achievement.
That's an achievement.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
You can also make it even longer if you use lakes.
And apparently tunnels.
Just the mental image that the forums had of a bunch of Incan guys putting the boat on their shoulders and going hup, hup, hup all the way down the tunnel.
I once had an instance like that where it was actually someone was using my tunnel, but I had a super long mountain range. It was like almost half the map. An AI used my tunnel to fight someone else. I had to sit there for the entire animation. It was like people walking from the start of the tunnel on one side of the map to the other side of the map to attack a unit that was on the other side of the tunnel and then walk all the way back.
Oh.
That took forever. Bad enough when I'm waiting for my GDRs to walk 36 tiles because they have 9 movement on a railroad, and I'm like, Jesus Christ, would you ever get there already, please? You're doing robots, you can run.
The Audio Gang Awards finalists have been announced, and the gang is the Game Audio Network Guild, which, doing some research into this, I'm not sure what they are or if they're even worth mentioning, but it seems like they're trying to be like the video game version of the Oscar Grammys. Of the Grammys or whatever. And this year, the Cree song for the Atomic Era, Pounds of Drum Maker, or the Drums of Pound Maker.
That's going in the bloopers.
There's an episode title.
That's awesome.
Was nominated for Best Original Choral Composition for this year, for last year.
Oh.
Which I have listened to that song recently, and it is a gorgeous song.
I really do like the Cree music for all the eras. It's really good. It was one of my favorites. That, and surprisingly enough, Scotland was one of my favorites in Rise and Fall as well, even though I was really surprised to actually enjoy a bagpipe song.
Bagpipes are awesome, though.
You say that when you guys are over on that side of the Atlantic. Over here, it's just annoying.
I was going to say, yeah, somebody here might have an opinion about that, because probably Es gets to hear them all the time, and he's like, oh my god, shut up.
Every blooming year, you're in the rugby.
They come over to visit, and you're like, oh no, not these guys again.
Mm-hmm. But yes, the Cree music tracks are very good.
I would say that the music tracks for every civilization are really good. I can't think of one that I really don't like.
Oh yeah, I can't think of any that I dislike, but the Cree is definitely one of the ones that stand out to me. That and the Canada now, because I've had that stuck in my head for 2 weeks.
I was about to cough and say, oh, Canada. When
yeah, I know, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh God.
I mean, we've got Mongolian throat singers too.
I suppose the thing for me is this... I haven't really listened to the music as it is, because it's always just background music in the game to me. Like, I know it changes obviously with the eras and based on who you've met and who you're fighting and all that, but to me it just kind of is like music.
I always appreciate it. I do listen to it, and I get excited when I see when I meet certain leaders in the game, because I'm like, yes, I'm going to get to hear their music.
But if you go to a city that has great music, and then so you start meeting everybody else, you're like, shut up, I want to listen to my music.
Yeah.
Case in point, yeah, the always here in Canada.
Go away, you. Bring back Victoria so I can listen to Scarborough Fair some more.
Well, then also there were changes not documented or obvious in patch notes. It's like, I don't know if it was actually in the patch notes, but nobody told me before the expansion we were going to have queues. I get queues back.
Really? You didn't?
Yeah, it turned up in some of the streams at least. Then yeah. I heard about it. I don't actually watch the streams, but.
Yeah, but I don't think at any point was it a bullet point thing for us during talking about what was coming up. And so when we played that first game on the Thursday night when the game had launched, and it's like, wait, that's a queue.
It's
a nice surprise.
One, but yeah. It is a queue.
It works.
It's in the patch notes, too.
Okay. It is in the patch notes. My bad.
That's a documented change.
It's not quite as bad as Civ 5's queue, where if you wanted to move things around, you had to click up and down arrows for like each individual one, because at least in this one, you can drag and drop items once they're in the queue. But it's still not quite as smooth as Civ 4's queue was.
Oh, it's unfortunate how, like, that they can't even come close to what they once did with this stuff.
Well, I don't know if we talked about this on the show or not, but somebody suggested that the reason is because they have to make it usable by touch users.
Yeah.
So
there have to be buttons big enough that you can touch it with your finger. So.
The workaround for that, though, is to still have hotkeys for it. Like, you can not force the use of hotkeys, but you could just have the hotkeys be available still.
I would have also thought that a simple drag and drop interface would have been like even easier for a touch screen.
In principle.
Because yeah, my favorite thing about the Civ 4 queue was you could not only drag and drop things around within the queue, but you could just, if I remember correctly, you could just drag items from the build list into the queue.
Oh, I never did it that way. I always just used Shift Control and Alt Click.
Now, if I remember correctly, you could drag an item from the build list into a specific spot on the queue. I could be misremembering, but I'm pretty sure you could do that.
Yeah, I don't remember that, but you might be right. I didn't utilize it.
And it was helpful. So, like, if you unlocked something new, you know, like you unlocked a new builder or a new unit, and you're like, all right, well, I want to finish the thing I'm building now, and then I want to build this thing next, but I've already got two more or three more things in the queue, you just drag it to second in the list, and voila.
They fixed the seed return cities weirdness. Whenever you make peace, you have to do one or the other, and there's no option to not do it.
Yeah, by default, in the peace deal, it will automatically have seed for the stuff you're occupying. You either keep it or you forcibly give it back to them by taking it out of your side and automatically puts it on the other side.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
So definitely confirms that. Although I have found a bit of a nuisance when it comes to taking cities is that, again, something that was undocumented, loyalty of occupied cities is reduced based on the number of grievances you have with that person. And if you eliminate a civ, you the cities of that civ have a permanent loyalty reduction because your grievances with that civ never decay.
Oh, that sounds bugged. That doesn't sound right.
Oh, no, I do not like that.
Yeah, I've had conquered capitals that have had a permanent minus 10 loyalty from grievances with city owners, even though they're dead.
Mm, yeah, that's...
Okay, I call it shenanigans on that one. That's not ideal. That should not be a thing, no.
Yeah, that's probably a bug rather than undocumented, but I think it is also undocumented in that there was always a loyalty hit for being an occupied city, but it was never scaled based on the grievances, or at least now it's scaled based on grievances rather than just being a set amount.
There's apparently a bug in getting all the governor's era score, because since there's an eighth governor, nobody but Ottomans can get it.
I didn't actually notice that, but even though I didn't have gotten, in fact, the game I literally just finished early this morning, I ended up with all governors and all promotions because I had so much culture, and you're right, I didn't actually get that era boost. Not that I needed it, but yeah.
And it looks like the lake wonder national wonders may behave like lakes now.
I thought they always did.
Yeah, I thought those were working as of Rise and Fall.
Yeah, I always had, as of Rise and Fall, I've always had Crater Lake get affected by Huey or at least by the harbor buildings. I've always had it with Dead Sea, Lake Retba.
Lake Retba and Dead Sea are no longer considered sources of fresh water.
Well, that was
I think that was the issue, was that you couldn't put like aqueducts to them or whatever.
Well, with the Dead Sea, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, in that case, it does.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to drink anything out of that.
A big thing that I only found out while trying it, Inquisitors were nerfed to be the same as proselytes or apostles. They only take at 75%. However, Philip apparently gets his are still 100% effect, which is interesting though, because I've gone around to be like someone next to convert or puts a translator apostle into my city that I just founded, and I'm like, right, send an Inquisitor, and I use it, and like, why is the religion still there?
Yeah, I don't remember the last time that I used an Inquisitor, because like when I tried using them last time, I did not find them particularly effective.
I mean,
and so I just stopped using them.
I mean, I still use them as they're handy as an emergency, defense against a religious push.
Yeah, I just haven't felt that I needed to do that since they made it so that your military units could kill religious units, so you can always just fall back on the declare war and condemn all their units, and that basically wipes their religion out of your empire because it gives negative pressure or whatever in all the nearby 25. Cities. So since then, I just have not found Inquisitors to be worth creating. I would rather just create more missionaries and apostles, but that could just be me.
Have battering rams always worked with triremes?
What is the text on a battering ram? Adjacent melee units?
I think, yeah, it just says melee units. So
then technically, yes, because galleys and the like are naval melee. I presume it also works with like anti-cav units, so basically it would be the same as oligarch.
In the game's defense, triremes were predominantly used to ram things and then board them. So ramming the harbor and then boarding it, if you put a battering ram on the trireme, it would work, right?
Yeah, sure.
Apparently they also buffed a crap ton. They also buffed all of the other unique city-state improvements, I guess, because all the new ones were like looking way too powerful in comparison.
Well, and so many of them were even just weak beforehand.
Yeah.
Like, two faith or something, or two culture. I'm like, eh.
They were kind of crap, but now Alcazar gives science equal to that's equal to part of the appeal. Colossal heads, I think, are worse. More tourism, leisure. Monasteries now give housing, stuff like that.
They really needed that. Like, a lot of the stuff was not even worth building. So, like, they should at least be worth building.
I could have seen the Alcazar also providing housing.
I'm not sure if it does now or not. I don't know. I haven't really looked at them all that much because I don't build very many of them myself. The only times I really only ever build a unique city-state improvement is if I have a Petra city that has lots of flat desert.
I think I've built the Cahokia Mounds a couple times.
Oh, yeah. I've done that as well. Yeah. They're interesting, was it?
Gold, I've seen those in real life.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly what they did. I just remember building them and being like, oh, that's pretty nice.
Stone quarries now give production bonus, adjacency bonus to industrial zone.
Did they not
always?
Before?
They didn't.
I thought it was
least,
all mines.
They didn't in vanilla, at least. I don't know if they did. I don't know if they did in Rise and Fall, but I know they didn't in vanilla.
I thought it was always that the industrial hub got adjacency bonuses from mines and quarries.
Yeah, all mines and quarries, I think, anyway.
Yeah. I personally think it should also give you adjacency bonus for strategic resources.
Technically, because every strategic resource, apart from horses, is mined. So,
well, yeah, but I feel like it should get a bonus from being next to horses, too, since they have military application.
Probably.
But that might be too complicated to make it one resource and not just all improvements.
So one of Kree's bonuses changed based on, it used to be slightly different based on how the food was added, but apparently that's been changed as well.
Oh, what's the change?
I don't remember what it used to be, but apparently now it's based on the food in the sending or in destination city as opposed to the origin city, whereas it used to be on the origin city only. It was like bonus food based on pastures or bonus resources or something.
I think that one's changed a couple times. I think that one was patched sometime after Rise and Fall came out as well. So I guess they're patching it again. Or at the very least, they've changed the description. Because I remember, I think when Rise and Fall first came out, the description was like not correct, not accurate. One other frustration that I've had with the build queue is that when you put districts in the queue, they don't immediately get plopped. So I'm not sure if it locks in their production cost. When you do that, I'm assuming it doesn't. So something that I've been doing just out of habit is if I'm going to be placing multiple districts, I place them all one at a time, and then, just so they get plopped to lock in their production cost, and then I put them back in the queue.
I haven't tried it. The only thing I've noticed about the queue is that you can't queue up all three tiers of buildings in a single district.
Yeah, I wish you could do that as well. If you had the prerequisite in the queue, you should be able to queue up the next.
If I'm building the holy site, why can't I go ahead and queue up the shrine and the temple if I've got the tech?
Yeah.
Someone else also said apparently you can now build wood, you know, plant woods next to lakes again. I haven't tried it, though, so I don't know if that's accurate.
I didn't know you couldn't before.
You couldn't, yeah. You could never... Any tile that was next to a lake, you could not plant woods on. If woods were there and you chopped them, you could not put them back. I noticed it every time I was, like, saying, oh, hey, that's a lake. That's, you know, one of those lake wonders. I can turn that into a national park. Let's plant some woods for appeal. And I can't.
I assume that was a bug. I can't imagine that was by design.
I don't know. It was odd. I don't know if there's any other undocumented changes I haven't seen. Oh, yeah, Big Ben was nerfed down to 50% gold instead of double your gold.
I thought that was documented.
Was it documented? Okay.
It's hard for me to remember exactly what it was. But yeah, that's true. You do not get as much money from it now.
Still worth saving up and just getting a crap ton of money like that, but still.
If score victory is turned off, you cannot see a list of scores. Interesting.
That a doc change? I guess it's just if you turn off score victory, it means they disable that tab. I suppose, in the victory screen, which...
Yeah, or it just doesn't even bother counting score. I think it would have to, though, for the your ranking at the end, right?
Yeah.
So it must still calculate. I guess it's just that tab just disappears.
Yeah.
So if you turn off science victory, it just disables that science tab. Yeah.
You can't research anything because there's no victory for it.
Oh, dear.
We don't need this.
Yeah, you don't need science at all. We aren't even going to give you the beakers because you don't need it.
We're playing a science game.
No. Yeah, you don't need
it. The game would be winnable because you could just kill people with warriors, I guess. They wouldn't be able to build walls.
So anyway, I guess if you were using the score tracker to, you know, keep track of, like, relative performance, then I guess you can't do that anymore if score victory is turned off.
Comparing yourself on score is always a bit meh anyway.
Yeah. You shouldn't be doing that. But if you were doing it, you can't do it anymore.
Well, part of the problem is that score is poorly allocated. In other words, it's not reflective of your present strength. It doesn't have to be true, but it's been true in Civ for ages.
I almost feel like the era score is a better score tracker than the actual score.
Even that's questionable, though, because you have like peaks and valleys in that regard, and you get massive empires with relatively weak era scores for the moment.
Especially, it's also the case that you can far too easily take all your era score and get it too early, and then you have nothing you can really get in the late eras if it goes that.
Yep.
Like, I've had us where I could be at, like, 500 era score at the end of the modern, then into atomic era, and suddenly I'm like, I can't gain any more era score. I've extracted all the artifacts and shipwrecks, I've built all the buildings, I've fully built all the districts and all that. Suddenly I have no way to gain era score.
Yeah, that's lame. If you're already, like, strong, you've already invested the resources, but you just can't get credit because you've already done it all.
Yeah, I've had plenty of game where I'm like 20 points over getting a golden age, and I'm like, oh, I really wish there was some extra benefit for overflow, but
can't I bank this overflow, dang it.
I've had enough gains where I've basically stopped my scouting units for a few turns. It'd be, don't explore anymore. Do not circumnavigate the world until the era ticks over.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yep. I've had that before. Or, I'm 2 turns from a wonder, but I'm 3 turns from the next era. So, if somebody gets this from me, I'm going to be real pissed.
Oh, yeah. The one final undocumented change that I noticed is that they improved the UI for boats, because, and I've seen this myself, your units will actually sail through other naval units and embarked units rather than constantly trying to sail around them.
Oh, nice.
I had that in the previous game, where I'd have a ship in front, I could see an embarked unit, so I just can't see the tile behind. And in previous games, I clicked to go around, to go, you know, through that unit, and my ship would actually go around and waste extra movement. Now it just tries to go through.
Speaking of that, I think I've actually seen, I don't know if this is a bug or if it's a new feature, but I've seen a couple instances where I would try to move, like, a scout or something into the fog of war, but there's, like, a unit or something there.
Yeah, and you get teleported back.
So you get teleported back to where you started instead of just stopping on the last tile before you move into that tile, which in previous versions actually did allow you to overlap other units in some cases, but now they just send you back to where you started. But, but they don't refund you your movement points either.
Yeah, it's
really inconvenient.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a bug or by design. I can understand it being by design, but it should refund the movement. Saying,
I
can't move here. You're going to have to go somewhere else, sort of thing.
Right. I feel like this teleporting you back is by design, but I'm not sure if the taking away your movement points is the way they intend for it to work. Because I could definitely see them being like, oh, well, we have the one unit per tile rule. We don't want to break that because of the fog of war. So we move you back. But yeah, they should definitely give you your movement back, or at least give you 1 point of movement back or something to move somewhere else. Because I can definitely see you still have the situation where, well, now you've uncovered a part of the map that you should not have been able to uncover. But it really does suck, especially for, like, if you're... because I think the first time it happened to me, I was trying to run my scout away from a barbarian, through a bunch of city-state units. And my scout just got teleported back and killed by the barbarians. And I was like, well, that blew.
Well, at least they don't just attack anything in the fog of war like they did in Civ 5.
I remember losing too many scouts to that, just accidentally running them into a barb camp, and I'm like, you could have stopped and told me.
Yeah, that's some really crappy UI stuff. I'm glad that they did some stuff to help the UI, but man, it's still really bad.
Speaking of awkward segues
in regards to diplomacy, it's another thread on Civ Fanatics where people are complaining about the diplomatic victory that has come in with Gathering Storm. Mostly it's a case of, and what I've noticed, in that when you're coming close to a diplomatic victory, the AI dogpiles you in the World Congress to stop you. And
even
I've actually
so
had that
with
myself.
Other victories?
Oh, yeah, they jump on, like, for example, in this particular thread by I'm not even gonna try and pronounce that OP name, but it was a World Congress result where he basically put every single point of diplomatic favor in that he could to win, which was worth 49 votes, and all the other AIs combined to counter him with negative 78 votes.
Wow.
I mean, I guess if you're voting on who wins the game, like, this should be expected.
You would expect the AI in this case to act in self-defense and go, oh, hell no.
I feel like my favorite version of the diplomatic victory so far was in, I want to say, Civ 5 Gods and Kings, where you were not allowed to vote for yourself. So the diplomatic victory was building friendships and alliances with the other civs so that they would vote for you.
Wasn't that, though, a case of you couldn't vote for yourself, but all your city-states still voted for you?
Yeah, yeah. Everybody except one guy who has one city and then be friends with all the city-states. Look, diplomatic victory.
In that sense, it was genuine, though, because it was a genuine economic victory.
Well, in Civ 5 Vanilla, it was an economic victory. But I think in Gods and Kings, it was more about building coalitions and getting the other AIs to like you enough to vote for you.
It did help in that sense. And obviously, there were things you could do that would almost make them pledge their vote to you, such as, you know.
Yeah, I think you could bribe them.
And stuff like that, or bribing them, for example. But I still think it was mostly you couldn't vote for yourself, but your city-state still voted for you, so you could still technically win it economically. As far as I know, the only true, pure diplomatic voting was in the Renaissance scenario in Gods and Kings, because you had to vote for someone else, and there were no city-states to affect it, I don't believe, anyway.
So,
but yes, I have had this happen myself. I was in my Mali game, and it was coming up to the case where it was like the last World Congress. I think I was on 7 points at the time, and I was like, yeah, sure, I'll throw a few votes in. Like, I wasn't actually really trying, because there were other ways of winning, so I just threw, I'll just like throw 11 votes myself. And then I turn around, and the AI all band together and put negative 50 votes to make me lose a point. And I'm like, well then.
Well, the trick is that after they've done that, they now don't have the favor to do it again.
Yeah, I did notice that, and I was like, it didn't matter to me at that point. I could have easily gotten the 2 points next time, because I still had my like 9,000-10,000 favor, and they had nothing.
Yeah, I think you get most, if not all, of your diplomatic favor back if what you voted on fails to pass.
You get it all back, yes.
Is it all of it? Okay.
If you vote on the resolution that is rejected, you get everything back. If you vote on the resolution that passes but not your targets, you get 50% back.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise, if it's your correct outcome and correct targets, you spent all that favor.
Now, I'm personally of the opinion that diplomatic victories will never really work well until multiple civs can actually win the game together in some kind of joint or cooperative victory.
Yes.
Because then you actually do have the other civ's best interests at heart when you're voting for them. So until that happens, to me, diplomatic victory is always just kind of going to be a weird crapshoot kind of thing.
It's also a bit of interest because, obviously, when they were going on about diplomatic victory, it kind of made you think, you'll get a couple of points, you know, sprinkled around the game, and then World Congress gets you most of them. But no, you actually really don't get that many outside of World Congress. You can get 4 outside of World Congress.
I feel like all the victories in Civ 6 are way too backloaded, and there's not enough that you can do early in the game to really contribute to it, other than just, you know, researching texts and civics.
and killing everyone.
Yeah, definitely.
The only way you can get different victory points early game is by aid requests, which require someone else to push it. I mean, that makes sense, but there's no other, there's nothing else you can get in the World Congress to win a diplomatic victory point other than the actual like direct vote itself.
Yeah, I was expecting like every emergency to offer like a diplomatic victory point to somebody.
Yeah. Well, especially things like military and city-state emergencies.
Right.
Whereas they just give you a bunch of favor, which in theory can be spent to earn points, but I was expecting they'd give you a point.
Right, but only if you save it up for the next 3,000 years.
Yeah. It's especially confusing because all the other types of emergencies, that they still act as score competitions and there's still ways of gaining score, but it's still a case of either everyone wins or the target wins. There's no point for them tracking score if they're not going to award a diplomatic victory point to the highest contributor, for example.
Or some other reward.
Yeah. Like, I won a religious emergency not too long ago because someone converted randomly. I wandered in with a couple of apostles, converted the city away, but didn't have the highest score because the target had a random guru sitting in the target city for the entire period and garnered more score than my reconverting it away for however long. But we still got the same rewards. Like, there was no extra diplomatic victory point and all that. It was just a bit naff, shall we say.
I do feel like the original poster on this thread, though, is overreacting a little bit. Because, as we mentioned, you're going to get all of those diplomatic favor back. So you're just going to be able to vote on it next time.
Yeah.
Also, it's like the first time ever that somebody has complained that the AI has actually tried to not let you win.
Yeah, I know, right?
I should try for all the victories, not just this one, but there's nothing wrong with it trying.
He is accurate, though, in late game World Congress, it takes a while before World Congress to come around. I thought they said it was supposed to speed up over the course of the game. I have not seen that. It's been 30 turns regardless for me.
I don't think it's supposed to speed up. I think that was Civ 5.
Well, Civ 5, yeah, but I thought they said it was going to do it in this as well. But I do agree that it does need to, the pace of World Congress needs to ramp up over the course of the game, even if that means there's like multiple sets of resolutions that are in effect at the same time. But yeah, it does need to happen more often. Like, it should be like every 20 or 15 turns when you get into modern or atomic.
And it would be nice if there were more votes sprinkled throughout the game.
Yeah, more ways to get it.
So some of your very early game coalition building could actually translate into a couple diplomatic victory points.
Yeah, because right now the only getting it from an 8 victory is basically send a couple hundred gold to the target and you win, whereas the only other ways are Statue of Liberty, well, one person, and then your two future era, or your future era tech and future era civic, which technically means you can just sit there on, you know, get enough votes, win the World Congress vote when you have 6 points, get to 8, and then rush those civics and tech, and you win.
Clearly, what the game needs, though, is an apostolic palace.
Yes, and is it working exactly like it worked in Civ 4?
No, I vote against. I vote nay. Never defy resolution.
Defy resolution.
My religion, just one. Get right.
Never defy resolution.
If only you could. It would have been nice if you could do that in Civ 4 to just put you at war with the entire world. If you could defy the religious sector.
I don't know, that kind of sounds just like a military emergency in Civ 6 where everyone...
That would have been awesome.
The world considers you a villain, minus 50.
Oh, that's true, your cities probably wouldn't like it.
I guess I could maybe also imagine like a system where instead of it just being one winner of the game and everyone else loses, there's like a ranking. So it's not a win or lose. You'd be like, oh, well, I'm not going to get first place, but maybe I can get second place. I just don't know what the incentive for not being the number one winner would be.
I do like the idea of something like NATO Warsaw Pact happening and that affecting it, but, you know, the last thing we need is another new feature in this game while all these bugs still exist.
But that's what's going to keep happening, just fair warning.
I'm aware of that. I'm well aware of how game development works, but that doesn't mean I can't hope.
That's true.
The OP posted a subsequent post of the next vote where he actually tied 65-65 and the coin flip, or not the coin flip, but the thing of the person who had put the most of their favor in apparently cost him another point. So then he went on a GDR rampage.
Yeah.
So okay. He went for the real diplomatic victory.
Yeah.
When so diplomacy fails.
When diplomacy fails, fully upgraded GDRs.
So what was he spending all of his refunded diplomatic favor on then?
He was keeping it still.
Yeah, in the last screenshot in the thread, he has like 19,000 Diplo favor.
And on the second vote, he spent 16,000 favor trying to pass and didn't. So he just got it all back.
Oh, yeah, because I guess what's happening here is because the cost for each subsequent vote increases, all of those civilizations with a small amount of diplomatic victory are putting in their votes real cheap, whereas the one player who's voting for themselves, each vote is more expensive
than
the last.
Very expensive very quickly.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that the cost scales up. Yeah, so you have to have like exponentially more favor than all the other players in order to win, not just
you would have to like get theirs lowered.
Yeah, okay, so that is harder than I initially thought it would be.
It's why, so I think I remember someone arguing that in the very late game when you're going for diplomatic victory, alliances are a bad thing because you both gain the same amount of diplomatic favor from the alliance, but their votes are cheaper than yours.
Yeah.
You actually want to break your alliance late game.
Which is kind of the opposite of what a diplomatic victory should be.
Right, yeah, that's kind of a counter-incentive.
But as we established...
Kind of, I mean, very much so.
As we established earlier, the way to win the diplomatic victory is to just pump as much CO2 into the atmosphere as possible and then clean it up again.
Yeah.
And you don't need any allies for that.
Or just get an absolute crap ton of culture and constantly go future civic every turn. 50 Diplo favor every turn.
But if you do that, you'll probably win culture victory.
Well, it depends. If you can get culture while ignoring tourism somewhat.
Or you could just take all the Diplo favor and the peace deals of Mars and then declare yourself winner.
They only give you 20. They won't give any more than 20. And once they see that you're actually stockpiling it, they won't give you any.
Really? Even in a peace deal?
Even in a peace deal.
Okay, in that case, you just conquer everybody except for whoever doesn't have a lot of Deathblow favor, and then you just win.
Yeah, that way.
The standard, the answer for everything, basically, still applies.
Kill it.
Take out the opponent so it can't vote against.
Persuasion by force.
The Grimbeck strategy. Kill all the things, including the planet now, because he loves doing CO2 emissions.
Yeah, why doesn't using nukes affect the environment at all?
Wait. I haven't got that far. It doesn't?
Yeah, no, it doesn't either. Add CO2.
What?
Well, I mean, it is true
it
that...
It would add CO2, but it would have pretty devastating consequences.
Yeah, there should be like a separate nuclear winter thing on top of the global warming.
I was going to say, if the CO2 is going to be our only measure for the climate change in the game, then the nuke would have to affect that, because that would definitely change the climate.
It might not add terribly much.
Make it disaster related to it. Like, if you have enough nukes, then you start having, like... farm productivity decreases from nuclear winter event. You could do that within the confines of the game.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I think it makes sense because, you know how currently a nuclear reactor doesn't add very much CO2 when it's burning a uranium to make power.
Can't the nuclear reactors in Gathering Storm also melt down?
Oh, yes.
They can.
What exactly is the effect of that?
After 20 turns, you are in danger of it.
I've not actually had it happen yet. I've had, out of the last two games where I've deliberately not been recommissioning my reactors just to find it happen, I've had two steam leaks, one at 16, one at 26, and I've had one minor radiation leak at 46.
And what exactly are the effects of these things?
A steam leak contaminates contaminates the industrial zone and every tile surrounding it for one turn and possibly pillages the radiation.
And what exactly, again, I haven't seen the contamination yet, so what exactly, is that just something that you clean up with your builders, like the fallout in Civ 3?
Yeah, you clean up with a builder, it takes a builder charge to do so, it also makes the tile completely unworkable. The level 2, if you get a radiation leak, it, I believe, completely pillages the industrial zone, I think it pillages surrounding stuff as well, and you have the radiation for 10 turns. I've yet to have a meltdown, though. Despite having reactors going for like 60, 70 turns, I'm yet to have a meltdown.
And does dropping a nuke create the contamination?
Yes.
It just doesn't affect the climate?
It does, yes.
You can still deny people tiles that way, then, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When you nuke somebody, the contamination stays for 10 turns or 20 turns, depending on which type of nuke you use.
Yeah, 10 turns and radius of 1 for standard nuke, 20 turns and radius of 2 for thermonuke.
Speaking of nukes, there might or might not be a bug that involves a certain civilization that is well-versed with nukes. If you launch a nuke at the civilization of Canada and you don't declare war on them first, you will nuke them and you will not be at war with them. because they cannot have a surprise war declared on them.
And when you press the mute button on a save, it automatically surprise wars them. That's it, you can't surprise war Canada.
Yeah. What do you do? Because you just do a joint war.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
Yep. So, and topic. Yeah, we got to the bottom of the topic list for once. No, wait, not for once, but I mean...
I was going to say, I don't think we've ever had a show where we didn't, where I've been in charge, but...
I mean, okay, we got to the bottom of the topic list, but we didn't do it so fast that it took less than an hour. This has been episode 332 of the podcast. I'm Makalua, as usual, and with me, Canis Albinus.
Let's not nuke Canada. They have too much maple syrup.
Irradiated maple syrup. Wait, this isn't Fallout. The Mian team.
What a tasty treat, without consequences.
Mega Bears fan.
I will now go back to destroying the world for diplomatic favor.
And our guest host today, Chris D.
And I'm going to go generate all the culture for diplomatic favor.
You guys are just so diplomatic. Just go kill all the things. It's recommended by one out of one Frenchman.
I like doing it, but
I'm doing both at the same time.
Killing everything, including the planet, yes.
Yeah, right.
February 23rd, 2019. Civilization 4, 5, Beyond Earth, and 6 Sound Clips Copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright The Polycast at thepolycast.net.